Angzon hoffs every word like he's following a prophet. There's Bart Pronk, who maintains the 10-week online course on the method. Bart was by Hoff's side all the way up to the top for the last two trips. There's a barrel-chested 76-year-old man named Francis, and a practitioner of holistic healing who is currently fighting off chronic Lyme disease. One woman is recovering from lymphoma. Then there's Sylvia, the owner of a series of marijuana shops outside of Amsterdam, who says she hasn't had a full night's sleep in more than 20 years. All in all, good people. The group is so hospitable to the lone non-Dutch speaker that the entire expedition decides that they'll speak English for the duration of the trip, a language that, owing to the fantastic educational systems of the Netherlands and Belgium, all the participants are fluent in. Even the gender mix is more equal than in previous years, with 8 women on board for this journey, where previous expeditions only managed 1 or 2. Despite all of this, it's hard to fight the sense that now that Hoff has proven his technique so many times, that most of us don't have any fear of failure. Not one person expresses any hesitation about reaching the summit, and it reminds me of the most important warning that firewalkers get before they run over hot coals. The only people who get burned are the ones who aren't nervous. Of course, the most certain of us all is Hoff himself. He's planning to wear the same outfit that he wore on the plane from Amsterdam all the way up the mountain. A bright blue pair of swimming trunks featuring a school of tropical fish, safety cone orange sneakers, and a gray tank top. In the blue plastic garbage bag that stood in for his carry-on bag, he's carrying one other item, a blanket. This, his mountaineering outfit slash formal occasion uniform, is all that I will see him in for the entire week that we are in Tanzania. Always looking for a way to set the upcoming achievement apart from earlier ones, Hoff announces that together we will smash his previous record by a half day and make it to the top of the mountain in just 30 hours. This, he tells us, would be a record for the fastest unacclimatized ascent of the mountain by a group. The information seems to pass over us without comment. It's as if merely being with Hoff is enough to ensure success. Footnote. It's hard to be sure what the fastest group ascent of Kilimanjaro actually is, because those records do not seem to actually be recorded anywhere. However, the fastest solo ascent of Kilimanjaro was done in 6 hours and 42 minutes by Kilian Jornet, a Spanish mountaineer and ultra-runner who had previously acclimatized his body to the height. An email into my inbox, however, tells a different story. When I learned of the speedy plan, one that even surpassed what I had told the tout in Moshi, I dashed off a message to John Castellani, the Army doctor at USAerium, who I'd met a few months earlier. I asked him to give me a realistic estimate, based on his experience and research, of how our group might fare against the potential ravages of limited atmosphere. Castellani relayed my inquiry to a few experts at the base, and within a few hours he wrote back that 60 to 75% of us should expect to get acute mountain sickness, AMS. To put that in perspective, that would mean that between 17 and 21 of us could begin to experience the downward effects of limited oxygen, starting with headaches and dizziness, and potentially ending in a fatal situation. Seeing the number at first gave me a sense of pride, as if it were a challenge. Of course we will beat that number. But I'd be lying if I were to say that my confidence wasn't followed by a twinge of fear. What if something does go wrong? The reason that Hoff's method is so effective against altitude sickness is that the constant and rapid breathing compensates for the lack of available oxygen. Since every step up the mountain means that each lungful of air is a little less rich, the solution is just to breathe more. As long as you never let up breathing consciously, AMS should never really be a problem. But what would we do if someone fell seriously ill? The previous year's group boasted a 92% success rate, which means that at least a few people were not okay on the mountain. The medical report from the ascent mentioned that one climber's lungs filled with fluid and that his heart started beating irregularly. Would we all be able to keep up our breathing routine if we had to respond to an emergency? Might one person getting AMS make other climbers lose focus as they tried to help? There would be guides, of course, for safety. One burly Tanzanian named Mike Nelson, who would lead the local support team, boasts of having been on the historic mission to recover George Mallory's body off of Everest in 1999. His small team of climbers found the Englishman's corpse on the ledge where he'd fallen to his death 75 years earlier. The oxygen on Everest is so sparse that despite their best efforts, they couldn't mount the strength to actually transport his corpse back to base camp. Instead, they looted his pocket watch, clothing, and gear for what would become a museum exhibit. They then covered his naked cadaver with a cairn of stones. Almost a dozen men like Mike would be there with us if we got into trouble, but their presence is no guarantee of safety. If someone gets into trouble, the guides might not be nearby, because we won't all be moving at the same pace. For my part, I've begun to wonder why I'd come to Tanzania in the first place. After almost 4 years of following the method, part of the impetus for coming on the trip was simply inertia, like what happens when a couple gets engaged and then drifts towards the wedding date despite whatever second thoughts they might be having. Getting to the summit is, in my mind, somehow inevitable. It's my goal to challenge myself with something impressive, but the specter of what might happen on the mountain plays on repeat in my brain. But at best, I am an amateur mountaineer, an avid hiker, but not someone who heads up into the mountains every weekend. The grounding concepts of the Wim Hof method are simple enough. By routinely stimulating a stress response, a person can take some modest control over their fight or flight reactions. 1,000 cold showers have made me a warrior in the bathroom, and even the snow. But no human ever evolved to thrive at 18,000 feet. The goal of the method isn't to make a practitioner invincible to the elements. The hundreds of thousands of fallen soldiers in the Siberian winter prove that in the battle against nature, nature always wins. Exercising the stress response just allows a person to assert a measure of control when the environment gets challenging. There's not really enough time to get to know everyone in the group, but I pair up with a curly-haired man in his 50s named Emil. We size each other up as likely candidates who would keep about the same pace. He is fit, but more important, he always seems to have a smile on his face. He's my buddy for the trip, and we'll be responsible for checking in on each other's health. We each have a copy of the Lake Louise score criteria, the method for rating the severity of acute mountain sickness that Geert Buys recommended. Developed in the high-altitude lake near Canada that shares the name of my mother-in-law, it is really just a list of potential symptoms next to a corresponding self-rating. We promise each other that if either of us exhibit symptoms that accumulate to a diagnosis of mountain sickness, we'll start down the mountain together. There's a local news crew at the park gate waiting to interview Hof. The papers are curious about the Iceman's feats, and he's happy to ham it up for the camera. He explains that the expedition will break a record for the fastest group ascent to the top of the mountain. Then he does a series of splits and headstands so the crew will have some B-roll, supplemental footage, to go along with their story. When they're done, he comes up to us to give his own version of Henry V's speech at Agincourt. "This trip is not just about testing our limits," he begins. "It's about leaving our egos behind and delving deep into our physiologies." He pauses for a moment and smiles at a pun forming in his inspirational ether. "There is no ego on this mountain. Just we go." I do everything I can not to bury my face in my hands to stop myself from guffawing at the cheesiness. Given the speed of our upcoming ascent, he says the real challenge on the trip won't be the cold, but in keeping the oxygen levels up in our blood. So don't worry about being shirtless the whole time. If the cold gets in the way, then just put something on, and remember to keep checking your O2. It turns out that checking blood oxygen levels is quite easy. Just about every person has packed with them a small digital monitor that uses infrared light to measure O2 saturation in the blood. The device fits on a finger and gives readouts for heart rate and oxygen. A healthy reading measures at about 97% saturation or above. During the hyperventilation and retention exercises I routinely perform at my house in Denver, I can usually bring my levels down as low as 50% while holding my breath, a number that would indicate a chronic lung problem if it weren't temporary. But the higher we go on the mountain, the lower our O2 saturation will be. So the plan is to keep checking our levels every half hour and then start breathing faster and deeper if we drop below 90%. The human body's natural response to high altitude is to start breathing faster. Again, that's also how Diamox works. It simply increases passive respiration. So we will breathe quickly and continuously from the base of the mountain all the way to the summit in order to get ahead of any deficit that might develop. We let the plan sink in, turn our backs to the gate, and then start up a long dirt path into a canopy of jungle. A large sign at the Morangu Gate serves as a warning to anyone attempting the 18.6-mile route to be aware of the perils of the cold and limited air, adding that all hikers should be physically fit. We all more or less fit the bill. Shirtless, the group winds its way past the sign. Behind us are almost 60 porters carrying the various overnight baggage, food, and medical supplies that we might need on the trip. They walk with bags balanced on their head, and sometimes two or three hiking backpacks on their shoulders. Most of the porters are in their early 20s, and it strikes me that while we are planning an expedition to the summit, no one in the group is nearly as hardcore as the men carrying our bags. Most of them do the expedition every few weeks, which means that most of the porters are already acclimatized to the change in altitude. But that doesn't make their effort any less impressive. The first leg up to a hut called Mandara traverses a steep path through a densely packed jungle that would look at home as a set in an Indiana Jones movie. Small black monkeys call to each other from the forest canopy, and flightless birds hop through the underbrush and hanging mosses. Focusing on our breath, we are mostly silent on the climb, but we take time every now and then to admire some small piece of wildlife. A chameleon with pinprick eyes trying to blend into the surroundings, or an iridescent white slug crossing the path. At first, we try to stick closely together, with Hoff taking the lead next to Francis, the barrel-chested 76-year-old mountaineer. We move at a slow pace for about an hour before Hoff seems to grow restless. He huffs audibly, sidesteps the older man, and pushes past him. In a few minutes, he puts 100 yards between himself and the group, and then he almost disappears into the brush so that we only catch glimpses of his bright orange shoes now and again. The separation isn't for very long, though, because within a few short hours we burst out of the rainforest to a small series of A-frame huts for a light lunch. The meal consists of a fried half-chicken that is soaked in oil for so long that it resembles the undead. There's also a sampling of fruit, a dry dessert cake, and a tub of yogurt. The meal's mere size, even after factoring its relative unpalatability, is an assurance that we definitely won't starve on the ascent. Just as we set our teeth into the rubbery chicken, the sky outside the hut opens up into a deluge of water. The rainforest, true to its name, is making itself known before we reach the next climactic zone. Most people coming up the mountain would stay in these huts overnight, so as to slowly acclimate their bodies to the altitude. Though the rise from the gate to here only brought us to 8,860 feet, recommended protocols make ascending the mountain a painfully slow process. I suspect that there are very few hikers that feel the need for a pause at this juncture, but the stories of sickness that afflict most climbers are rightfully warning enough. It's somewhat reassuring to me that we are going to pursue a more aggressive pace, as stopping at 1 in the afternoon would make me go stir-crazy. So we look out at the torrent of rain as it fills the path with bright muddy puddles and decide to forge ahead. No one, of course, likes being cold and wet. I'm not sure exactly who among us first unzips their pack and ferrets out their rain gear, but when the first coat goes on, the urge for protection against the elements seems to spread like a virus. For me, the hardest part of cold exercises that I have been doing for 4 years is always the moment where I decide to actually get cold. Whether it's standing above the waters of a frigid lake, near a fresh pile of snow, or even just in a blazing hot shower with my hand ready to turn off the hot tap so that only the cold water flows through the pipes, the decision point where I jump in, lie down, or turn the faucet to cold is when my mind throws up the most resistance. The anticipation of discomfort is almost always worse than the actual experience. The inverse also turns out to be true. If one person acquiesces to comfort, it becomes much easier for other people to follow suit. So before we are even outside of the A-frame, the group is layered up in suits of rubber and Gore-Tex. Hoff dons the trash bag that was his carry-on as a makeshift poncho, and I throw on a bright yellow slicker. To me, the clothing bears the taste of failure. Only a few hours in, and I have already broken the skin-out covenant that I'd promised myself I would keep. The troop marches forward up the hill, all breathing in unison. It doesn't take long before I start sweating like a man in a rubber suit working out in the tropics, which, of course, I am. Half a mile from the cabin, I'm almost as wet on the inside of the jacket as I am on the outside. So I decide to stash it in my pack and let the water fall on my skin as a welcome relief. A few other people follow suit, and there's a tenuous balance in the group between the people who seek protection and those who are trying their hardest to remain pure. Soon the foliage of the rainforest starts to grow smaller and recede as we enter into a more arid zone. We're above the rain, and the sun brightens an otherwise gray sky. Now boulders, small cacti, and bristly shrubs pop up on the landscape. Our views extend to the extinct lava cones that make up the foothills of the volcano itself. Rather than take it all in, however, I mostly just look at the shoes of the man in front of me, Stef Van Winkle, a nearly 7-foot-tall Dutchman who also, incidentally, is the youngest person on the trip. He's breathing hard, harder than anyone else in the line. Every minute or so, he starts a succession of 30 rapid breaths and then holds and twists up his face so that he turns slightly red. He's practicing a technique that Hoff gave us for when we start experiencing altitude headaches. The method rushes oxygen to a specific part of the body and works equally well for sore limbs after a workout as it does for a headache. Like many things with the Wim Hof method, it's something that is easier to feel and experience than it is to describe in words. Hyperventilation decreases CO2 and increases overall oxygen in the bloodstream, while moving pH from acidic to alkaline. During retention, with lungs full of air, you sequentially tighten all the muscles from your extremities towards the place where you want to move the blood supply. The process is a little bit like wringing out a wet rag from one end to the other and pushing water out the end. It's hard to say exactly what you're physically moving inside your brain when you're targeting a headache. Perhaps it's the smooth muscles in the vasculature. Or perhaps you're just thinking at a particular spot. In my experience, after a few seconds of using this method, minor headaches vanish, and major ones decrease in their intensity. Van Winkle's breathing patterns worry me, though. We're barely over a third of the way to the top. Whatever benefits the breathing might lend, it's a bad sign that he's already fighting for oxygen. I ask him how he's doing, and he gives me a thumbs up with a nod. But his gesture doesn't hide the pain. So he keeps his head down and continues the slow march upward. I pass him and continue to move forward. 7 hours into the march, the group is spread out like a segmented line of ants, interspersed over what must be a few miles. My buddy is gone, so much for safety checks, and I think that I'm somewhere toward the front. The landscape is now dominated by some sort of large, spiny plant reminiscent of California yucca. I'm all alone, save for one Tanzanian guy named Joseph, who carries an overstuffed backpack. He has either found that my pace matches his, or he's keeping an eye on me. The sun sinks behind a bank of gray clouds, and a light drizzle coats my skin. But I'm feeling great despite the sudden drop in temperature. Joseph watches me from inside his puffy jacket, curious as to why I have not yet put anything on. We near an elevation of 11,000 feet. The air is much thinner than it was when we started, but the thinness also means that there is less air resistance. Oddly, this makes it easier to breathe quickly. My O2 levels never seem to fall below 95%. Out of curiosity, I ask Joseph to lend me his finger and let the device check him out as well. A second or two later, it settles on 82%. Not terrible, but far lower than I expect for someone who should already be acclimated to mountain ascents. We share a granola bar, and he tells me that Horumbo, the place where we will spend our first night, is not too far off. So I double my efforts and push forward at a brisk pace. The promise of a warm sleeping bag on a hard cot might as well be spurs prodding my ribs. The path snakes over a series of cold-looking mountain streams before ultimately a small village of A-frame huts peeks through the fog. Horumbo is a relatively well-maintained staging point. Most hikers attempting the Coca-Cola ascent arrive here during their second or third day on the trail. A sign announcing an elevation of 12,100 feet greets me in front of a thin radio transmitter that provides Horumbo's main form of communication with the outside world. Unsure of what to do next, I walk into one of the huts and find myself in a dining room where a Swedish expedition is enjoying their dinner. Every head turns to the half-naked man in their midst. There are smiles, and someone in the back shouts, "You must think you're Wim Hof," in what I take to be a jest. "He's around here somewhere. Have you seen him?" I ask, genuinely curious as to where the leader of our expedition has disappeared to. The man who yelled jumps up and almost runs to me. He's holding a camera in his hand. He starts to whisper in excitement, "Really? You're here with Wim Hof? He's an idol of mine. I can't believe you walked up here like this." I must look like a creature from another planet. But I have to admit that it feels good to be admired just for taking off my shirt. The Swede snaps a few photos of me outside and asks if it's possible for me to introduce him to Hof. The rest of the group arrives over the next 2 hours, and each shirtless mountaineer receives a hero's welcome. We are clearly the talk of the camp, and we all toast with hot tea and a hot meal as the rest of our group straggles in one by one. It isn't until Sylvia, the proprietor of the Dutch marijuana shops, arrives well past dark that I get a taste of what lies ahead. The climb has worn her out, and she's in tears when she crosses the cabin's threshold. She says that her head is pounding, and she falls against the wall with her head in her hands. A crowd gathers. Hof appears from somewhere and folds her into a paternal hug, warming her up at the same time as he whispers something into her ear. Someone measures her oxygen, and it is critically low, running at less than 50% saturation. Hof bends over so he can look her in the eyes, and they start to breathe together. She focuses on him, and after what must be 300 breaths, regains some control. Her tears dry up, but she's worn out. Meanwhile, a couple of guides confer with each other about what they should do next. If someone dies, it will be their own necks on the line. No one wants to hire a guide who lets someone die on their watch. In about 30 minutes, she'll be able to get her oxygen saturation back to above 90%. But there's no telling what might happen if she climbs farther. Someone decides that she'll have to go back. She's the first casualty of the hike. At night, the group sleeps head to toe in a long series of bunk beds that line the length of the longhouse. The windows are open to the night air in order to ventilate the CO2 that builds up in the small space with 30 people. At 3 a.m., an alarm goes off, reminding us all to check our oxygen levels and bring them back up to 90%. It's hard to get back to sleep, but at 4:30, Hof is full of energy and almost shouting that we need to get moving or miss our window to the summit. The hike will take 11 hours in progressively thinner air, and no one besides Hof feels motivated to get going this long before sunrise. Breakfast is a bland portion of porridge and eggs. It's far from delicious, but eating is important, so I try to pack in as much as possible in 5 minutes. That's when I notice Van Winkle, the tall Dutchman who was having trouble earlier, on the porch doubled over the banister. He's heaving hard and spewing what seems to be gallons of yellowish liquid over the edge. When he hears about Van Winkle's condition, Hof slaps him on the back and urges him onward. "This trip will separate the men from the boys," he says in a comment that might have been intended to be motivational, but instead falls a little flat. For all of his enthusiasm and inspirational achievements, Hoff sometimes lacks conventional social skills. Van Winkle looks at Hoff and shakes his head. "My choice seems to go down or die," he groans back. His climbing partner nods in agreement. Hoff seems disappointed. "Fine," he says. Then he calls to the rest of the group to get ready. It's time to go up. Hoff is an almost impossible figure to dissect. On one hand, he has something special, physical and mental abilities that seem to open the door to untold reservoirs of strength. He is a prophet whose message is spreading across the world in viral videos and scientific journals. He's a man whose love for all things human seems to know no bounds. He is also a madman who can be so solipsistically focused on his own abilities that he lacks the empathy to see limits in other people. When he abandons the group in search of a record, or when he delves into a 45-minute speech on how the cold and breathing can bring him deep into his own physiology, Hoff can fall into such a fit of self-centeredness that there isn't space for anything else. At sea level, or in a temperate zone, it's a personal foible that is easy enough to overlook. But those qualities can turn dangerous on a mountain where the lives of almost 30 people hang in the balance. So when the group leaves that morning in a line that is 2 people shorter than it was the previous morning, I wonder, am I following Hoff the prophet or Hoff the madman? As we trudge out into the darkness with only a line of headlamps illuminating a rocky dirt path, my choice of clothing telegraphs my unconscious answer to the question. Of the 27 of us, only one isn't wearing a shirt. It's cold, but I'm shirtless because I am not yet willing to abandon my faith in the method. I think warm thoughts of a fire burning in my belly as I walk forward, willing heat into my naked torso. Even Hoff is wearing a t-shirt and a blanket draped over his shoulders. Our aluminum poles and hiking boots crunch the dirt as we move ever northward up a volcanic chunk of rock that claims the lives of at least 8 mountaineers a year. Footnote: accurate casualty counts on Kilimanjaro are surprisingly difficult to obtain. Various sources indicate the number is between 3 and 10 reported deaths a year. The actual number may be as high as 30, since some cases may not make official records. Either way, there are 1,000 evacuations from the mountaintop every year. Our breathing is harsh and rhythmic, as if we are trapped in a room from which the air is being sucked away. It is as if any lungful might be our last, but we trudge forward through the darkness in focused unison until the fingers of orange light grab at the horizon and pull away the night. It is only then that the dark outline of a mountain peak begins to define itself. At first, it is only a dark purple absence of stars in a pinprick sky. As the heavens shrug off night's embrace, the sunlight sets the glacier ablaze like a beacon, the summit of Kilimanjaro. The tallest mountain in Africa rises up out of the sun-drenched savanna to a place high above the clouds. There, winds topping 100 miles an hour scour a glacier that is probably the only indigenous ice on the continent. For the past 20 hours, the peak was hidden behind the clouds and the mountain's own towering foothills. Now in view, the massive slab of igneous rock is no longer an idea that we might conjure up in our minds, but a real-life obstacle. The gradual 15.5-mile rise from the park gate comes to an abrupt halt at the base of the cone that rockets upward into a barren and inhospitable wasteland. Devoid of life and only home to a moon-like base camp, we hope to summit on almost no food, little sleep, and most strikingly for me, no cold weather gear. One of the guides that we'd hired in Moshi watches me warily from beneath his full thermal getup. "Please put something on," he says, confused by the rash display of skin. It's a sensible request. Even with the sun tempting the sky, the air temperature is well below freezing, and it's only going to get colder as we make our way higher. But the request is also an affront to why I am on the mountain in the first place. So I push his words out of my mind and try not to think of how the others in the group are dressed. I suck in a cool breath of air and focused my eyes on the blazing orange rock in front of me. I exhale something that sounds like a low guttural roar like a dragon just waking from a 100-year slumber. I feel the energy begin to build, the rhythm of the air quickens. My toes start to tingle inside my hiking boots. The world starts to brighten in my vision as if there are two dawns working at the same time, one tied to the rising sun, the other in the depths of my own mind. A coil of heat starts behind my ears like a lit fuse. It arcs across my shoulders and down the curve of my spine. There's no point in checking the temperature. It's cold, and I'm only just beginning to sweat. Or so I think. In another mile, we reach the saddle, a low, sloping curve of land that links a small, castle-like volcanic peak just across from Kilimanjaro's main cone. The shape of the land acts as a sort of wind tunnel that accelerates the gusts into gales. The taut straps of my backpack sing like a stringed instrument. We lope past a small circle of rocks that demarcate the border of a helipad that doctors use to evacuate victims of altitude sickness. Someone calls for the group to stop so that they can relieve themselves in a small wooden outhouse. The temperature hovers around 10 degrees, but the gusts create a wind chill that brings the temperature down to the negative 30s, a temperature that the tables I was given by Castellani say could frostbite exposed flesh in as little as 15 minutes. The Wim Hof method does not make a person impervious to the elements. Pausing the march, even for a few moments in such an exposed area, makes it all the more difficult for my body to generate the amount of heat that I need to fight the cold. As we mill around the helipad, I feel my body temperature sink. I know that it will take much more energy to get warm again. The break is only 5 minutes or so, but when we start up again, I can feel that I'm in trouble. Hof pushes past the front of the group and presses on. I wonder if his impetuousness is a symptom of needing to maintain a constant pace, that his own body temperature isn't maintained by his mental control alone, but also by the slow, steady work of his muscles. I watch the blanket on his back push further into the distance as I dip towards the nadir of the mountain saddle. The wind howls past me at some ungodly pace, and I start to think that it's more reasonable to put on a few layers here than to risk not reaching the summit at all. So I drop my backpack and pull out a thin merino wool shirt and wool sweater that will provide my skin with a little protection. They're not much of a barrier against the harshest gusts, but they're all I need to feel safe. With a burst of renewed energy, I pick up the pace until I catch Hof. The rest of the group further segments behind us. In some sort of optical illusion, the vastness of the landscape makes the distances look much shorter than they really are. Though the way forward is mostly flat, progress is insufferable. A trick in optics takes what looks like a 15-minute journey and stretches it into a grueling hour. It's been 5 hours since we left Harumbo, but we're so spread out now that the last people in the group won't reach our next waypoint for another 45 minutes. The mirage physically drains the group of its motivation. The waypoint ahead of us is called Kibo, the base camp for everyone who gets to the summit on the Coca-Cola route. It represents our last prospect for rest before attempting the summit. From there, Kilimanjaro makes a sharp upward incline. Kibo itself is far above the point where any plants are able to grow. It's a barren outpost that features a handful of stone buildings, a kitchen, and some quarters where rangers can stay for a few weeks at a time to monitor the constant flow of mountaineers who come through. We find a stone room with a collection of basic wooden benches and tables and try to warm up before our final ascent. Ordinary hikers will stop here overnight to acclimatize and rest, but our plan is to climb 6 more hours to the peak. It's not quite 11 a.m., and the clock is still on our side. Dennis Berentz, the CrossFitter and Ironman who hangs on Hof's every word like gospel, is shivering in the corner. When I donned a sweater in the middle of the saddle, he was inspired to take off his shell. He was half naked during the harshest part of the hike. Now he's breathing hard, trying to warm up. He's pale and his lips are blue. I pull a green puffy jacket from my bag and give it to him to wear. Hoff lies back on one of the tables and closes his eyes. They roll back into his sockets and flutter. He turns red, and when he opens his eyes, he is once again bursting with energy. One of the problems with following someone with superpowers is that my body doesn't obey the same rules of rest and recovery that his does. And now that we're close to the summit, his mind is focused only on setting a record. Everyone else is recovering and waiting for a hot lunch that we'd been told was on the way. Hoff checks the time. It's 11:40. Then he shouts, "Okay, everyone, we go in 20 minutes. We are not on the mountain because we want to eat. We are here to make the summit." The message lands flat in a room full of confused faces. I'm not the only one to mutter an obscenity. Sensing insubordination, Hoff revises his message 3 minutes later. "Never mind rest," he says. "We go now and make a new record." He launches himself out of the room and walks down the wide path between Kibo's humble buildings and into a collection of mountain guides. Mike Nelson, the guide who helped retrieve Mallory's effects off of Everest, tries to block Hoff's path. "You can't go now," he tries to command Hoff, but the gnome-like leader of our expedition simply brushes past him. He heads up the mountain towing two Belgian ladies who had come on the trip to enhance their corporate leadership skills. I watch the movement of his neon-orange shoes from the doorway while trying to decide whether I have a duty to follow the leader or if I should participate in what seems like a well-justified mutiny. I watch him grow smaller on the mountain. About a third of the mile from the camp, he turns and starts yelling something. I can't decipher his words. It could be a last-ditch effort to restore morale. It might just be a string of insults. I'm pissed. This is not the trip that I signed up for. And my faith in Hoff is quickly dwindling to a low point. But part of me also wants to know what happens next. So I come up with a compromise. I rifle through my bag and remove every warm weather article of clothing that I'd packed along. I throw on wind pants and a thermal top. I cover myself in a sweater and retrieve my green puffy jacket that I was only going to use in an emergency. I finish it off with my yellow raincoat. I'm positively toasty in all the layers. Not because I need all this clothing, but to protest against Hoff's impetuousness. Fuck the method. Fuck Hoff. Thus armored, I walk out of Kibo camp and yell up to Hoff, who is now in the middle of some sort of argument with the Belgians. "Hold up," I yell. My shout echoes off the canyon walls. I walk past the guides who are arguing with each other in Swahili. If something goes wrong with the ascent, they know that they will share the blame and the consequences. Only Bernards follows in my footsteps. The Belgian ladies have turned their backs on Hoff. He's all alone, standing in his shorts and blanket a few hundred meters above us. "Why not give us another hour?" I yell up the mountain. "Even the guides won't follow you." Perhaps the wind eats my words and sends them down the mountain, but Hoff hears them as an insult. "Don't you dare challenge me, Scott," he roars back with the wind howling an angry chorus. "How do I know that if I follow you that you won't leave me behind on the mountain like you have everyone else on this trip?" These words seem to reach him. Alone on the ledge above me, there's a realization going on. Yes, he can make the summit. But is it worth it if no one follows? It takes a while, maybe 15 seconds, maybe a minute, but he calls back. His voice is softer. "I won't leave you." He waits another beat. "I promise." It's not much, but in the moment, it's enough. In a few minutes, Bernards and I fall behind him. We gaze back at Kibo. It looks even more desolate from above. We can see the guides bickering and the Belgian ladies gesturing in our direction, but it's impossible to know what they're saying. "Maybe they will come," Hoff says with bitter optimism, but the three of us know that it isn't very likely. So he turns his back and takes a small step up the mountain. And then another. We follow. Pole pole. I watch his shoes and blue bird-emblazoned swim trunks for the next half hour, mostly in silence. There's just the sound of my aluminum poles following the crunch of his boots and constant breathing. The rhythm is almost hypnotic, except for a question that I just can't get out of my mind. Why would I follow a madman up a mountain? Hoff is many things, but a leader of men is certainly not one of them. I have my doubts about whether he will keep to his word, or, if we overcome one rise or another, if he will push on while my own strength flags. And it isn't until I see his shoe slip slightly on gravel, a minor misstep in which even his own profound fortitude falters for an instant, that I realize that I'm not following a madman. I'm not following a prophet. I'm not even following Wim Hof. I've come up the mountain after years of working on my own biology, one step after another. I'm following my own rules, my own relation to the group, and even the mountain itself. I don't care if we make or break a record. I want to know my own limits. The thought adds a certain jaunt to the next several steps. I'm not angry at him anymore. Suddenly, my layers of clothing and the protest they represent feel misplaced. I drop my bag to the ground and strip down to my waist. The wind isn't as fierce on this slope of the mountain, and even going slowly, I'm working hard enough to keep warm. If I do layer up again, it won't be because of anything Hoff says or does. Insane or not, this is my challenge. I will earn the summit or I will fall on my own power. Hoff keeps his hands clasped behind his back, focusing on every footstep on the path upward. The lip of the volcanic cone is still more than 2,500 vertical feet above us, but every step gets us that much closer. The slope dips slightly, eclipsing Kibo from view, but I look back anyway and see a smeared red silhouette barreling up the mountain behind us. He's gaining fast, taking two steps for every one of ours. I tell the others. We squint into the distance and recognize him as Salim Hamis Ngoye, one of the youngest guides on the expedition. Whatever the descent was below, he was either sent up to keep an eye on us or had broken away on his own. Even so, it still takes 45 minutes for him to catch up after we stop and take a break on a pile of rocks. We don't have much food with us, having skipped our resupply at Kibo, but I fish out two granola bars from my bag. Berents uncovers some sort of medicinal-tasting performance gel, and we share the small meal. We're so high up that it proves somewhat difficult to chew and breathe at the same time. Each mastication competes for space that we could use to draw in air. Our oxygen readings are all above 90, except for Hamis Ngoye's, who comes in below 90%. He hasn't been using the breathing method, and I wonder if simply being on the mountain every month has habituated him and the other guides to functioning well, even while at a deficit. Just like with the various ways that a body might choose to heat itself, there are a wide variety of strategies and techniques that our bodies can use to manage the lack of oxygen at altitude. But for me, the breathing method is effective. We continue upward in a line of four people with Hamis Ngoye in the front. Sometimes the rhythm of the march lulls me out of conscious breathing. My mind starts to wander, and I only take in as much air as my mind might see fit and forget to lead my breath. That's when the creep of altitude sets in. The world dims imperceptibly, and every footstep seems to fall just a little heavier. Then, as I realize that I'm fading, I start 30 rapid breaths, and the world brightens up as easily as if I were taking off sunglasses. My steps become lighter, and I have energy to continue. At this height, the mountain makes me keenly aware of my body. I even feel as if I can sense the energy from the granola bar coursing through me as the mitochondria in my cells greedily consume the sugars in exchange for brute muscle power. We pass a small cave and then a landing before we make a long, zigzagging traverse over what feels like volcanic sand. Craning my neck, I make out a white patch of snow above that signals the rim of the crater. Gilman's Point isn't the true summit of Kilimanjaro, but it's the point where you can cross over the top of the mountain and start going down the other side. The true peak, Uhuru, is another hour and a half around the rim of the crater, along with another few hundred feet of elevation gain. Hoff, Behrens, and I agree that for our purposes, Gilman's is enough. We don't need to go any further to prove anything to ourselves. An additional 3 hours of walking there and back just doesn't seem worth it for such a modest gain. Even so, the distance to Gilman's still induces vertigo as my vision telescopes in and out on the snow and a dark cloud that has started to engulf the summit. I opt to keep my head down. In another half hour, we reach a stretch where the gravel path gives way to boulders, a stretch called Jamaica Rocks, forcing us to go hand over hand in places. It is the most technical part of the climb, and it's made worse by the sky suddenly opening up and sending down a flurry of snowflakes and wind. It's about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, but later I would calculate that the magnifying effect of the wind on skin brings the real temperature down to minus 31. That's enough to cause frostbite in just a few exposed minutes, though I've been shirtless for the last several hours. I watch as Hoff stumbles on a set of rocks, sending his hand down onto the path. It's apparent that we're all reaching our physical limits. Between the speed of the ascent, the cold, and the wind chill, I know that I need to focus my energies just putting one foot in front of another. I put my sweater back on and awkwardly plant my poles onto the rock face as I prepare for the last push. There are many great mountaineers in the world, but I am not one of them. Hoff and Hamis Ngoye are both experienced climbers, but even the moderate boulder scrambling is a test of my abilities. The poles get in the way when I need to crawl, and it's hard for me to balance without them when I'm standing. As the three other climbers seem to vault airily over 1 6-foot ledge, I grasp the porous rock with my fingers and desperately try to find a hold somewhere below me for my toe. I slip, and my body crashes forward. I splay out with my arms akimbo. Hoff watches my cacophony of limbs and says to Behrens, or maybe just the air at large, he's fighting himself now. I'm too drained to take the comment as anything but an insult, but it's also true. I'm faltering on the mountain. I am fighting my own muscles and mind as much as I am the boulder that my body is splayed across. But God damn it, I'm going to make it to the lip of this mountain if it kills me. And this time, when I look up, I realize that our goal is just a couple hundred feet ahead. I can fight myself, or I can fight the mountain. At this point, it isn't even a choice anymore. Then, before I know it, we're there, breathless at the top of the African continent, maybe just a little shy of the true peak. But when we check our watches and subtract away our departure time, we calculate that we've more than beaten our 30-hour goal. We've crushed it. It has been only 28 hours and 6 minutes since we left the park entrance. To put that in perspective, when Hoff's group did the same trek a year before, it took them 42 hours to reach Gilman's Point. To the best of our knowledge, it's the fastest ascent ever to Gilman's Point by a group of people. Somewhere below us, the rest of the group is on their way up. They will reach the same point in about 2 hours. Altogether, 22 out of 29 will make it to the top without succumbing to AMS. Though Castellani and the U.S. Army predicted mostly failure, we will achieve a 75% expedition success rate. And so I breathe in that success in Kilimanjaro's thinnest air. The wind whips past the large wooden sign that marks the elevation, and I start to feel warm again. I take another 30 breaths, and I'm hot. So I take off my shirt again to feel the weather on my skin. Even if the wind only speaks in the language of frostbite, it feels like victory. I'm not on the mountain anymore. In this moment, I am the mountain. Epilogue: Cold Comfort. It's been 6 months since I last met with Rob Pickles at the Boulder Center for Sports Medicine, and things couldn't feel any more different. For one, the center has cut a deal with the University of Colorado Boulder and moved into a brand new facility attached to the school's sports arena. The state-of-the-art office overflows with meaty-looking football players and spindly endurance athletes. The upgrade comes with a new name, the CU Sports Medicine and Performance Center. But other than those cosmetic changes, the test that Pickles will do on me is essentially identical to the one I did with him the previous summer. There is no doubt that I feel different, though. After a few years of exploring ways to use the environment to peek into the inner workings of my body, I've learned a thing or two about my own limits in the world. I know that every person, even people who have jellyfish spirit animals, hide vast wells of inner strength. The secret to cracking into our inner biology is as easy as leaving our comfort zones and seeking out just enough environmental stress to make us stronger. Exposure to cold helps reconfigure the cardiovascular system and combat autoimmune malfunctions. It's also a pretty darned good method for simply losing weight. These are all things that I've seen in myself and in hundreds of other people who have had the will to delve deeply into their own evolutionary physiologies. More profound than that, however, is the intrinsic understanding that humans are not just bodies bounded by the barrier of their skin. We are part of the environment that we inhabit. Just a week off Kilimanjaro, I figure that I'm in the best shape of my life. My once expanding waistline has tucked back in. An old pair of jeans featured a 36-inch waistband, but my most recent purchase was a size 31. I used to suffer from occasional canker sores, painful dime-sized autoimmune lesions that I'd been getting since I was 2 years old. But I haven't had one since I started taking cold showers. For the last year, I'd been taking on a few big challenges, but my weekly exercise routine is pretty much unchanged. I run outside shirtless no matter the weather, 2 or 3 times a week. In the summer, I go through countless tubes of sunscreen, and in the winter, I sweat on 3-mile runs around the lake by my house. After working with Brian McKenzie at his facility in Southern California, I start throwing in a few HIIT sprints for good measure. All told, including the morning breathing routines, my fitness regimen takes about 3 hours out of my week. Before he starts hooking me up to breathing tubes and sharpening his medical lancets, I tell Pickles about my routines. This man, who spends most of his day with top-tier athletes, seems to chuckle inside. He isn't expecting much. So when he starts me on the treadmill once again, and incrementally increases the inclination and speed of every stage, it is more to humor me than it is to declare a new fitness paradigm. The first few minutes aren't much of a challenge, but as he pushes the machine faster and higher, I begin to sweat, and the rubber face mask starts to pull me awkwardly to the side. "You're doing great. You got this," he says as he pokes my finger with a small lancet in order to draw some blood. He feeds the sample into the machine and then increases the speed and inclination until it feels like I'm running up Kilimanjaro again. "You've done another stage more than last summer. Keep it up," he says. I smile beneath the breathing apparatus and give him a thumbs up. I run on until my lungs burn and my mind screams to stop. Then I put my feet onto the side of the machine and let the belt spin beneath me. In that moment of acquiescence, I think that I might have had a little more energy left in reserve. Maybe there is one more stage I could have done. I tell Pickles as much. "Everyone says that," he replies. There are a lot of numbers to crunch, and Pickles tells me to come back a few days later for the results. A week turns into a month, and in that time I continue my daily routines. Eventually, we make an appointment that sticks. And early one morning in February, I drive out to meet him. He greets me in the lobby of the center with a vigorous handshake, the first sign that the results are more interesting than he had expected. We sit down in a small conference room with a TV on the wall, where he can display the 40 pages of data points and complex math. He talks fast as he delves into describing the bicarbonate cycle, metabolic actions, and then he outlines a few equations that make my head start spinning. It's more than I can understand, so I ask him to bring it all down into regular English. Big picture, you're a lot more efficient with how you use energy now than you were when I tested you in the summer. It's like you've added 7 hours of exercise to your routine every week, he says. In addition to running longer on the treadmill, I'd burned more fat and fewer carbohydrates, meaning that I'd train my body to use less sugars and more stored energy. He shows me a few graphs to illustrate the points. Two charts testing fat and carbohydrate oxidation rates over time show two intersecting lines, a dark line for carbohydrates and a lighter line for fat. Back in May, the two lines had intersected before the third stage on the treadmill, but the levels plummeted as the workload increased. My body had to burn more carbohydrates to compensate until finally it flamed out after 6 stages. In the second chart from January, the two lines intersected in the 5th stage, and I ran 7 full stages. This meant that I burned fat for the bulk of the workout, which is huge, he says. Other things didn't change, though. In both studies, my lactate production was 3 times higher than the average adult's. Lactate is a byproduct of physical exertion and often correlates with long recovery times after intense workouts. It's the acidic byproduct that makes you sore after running a race. Given the change in fat burning, Pickles expected something more here, but he shrugs. Everyone's physiology is different, he says. Overall, the changes in my physiology are too big to be accounted for by simply one climb up a big mountain, even something as challenging as Mount Kilimanjaro, but instead mark a prolonged change in the way my body uses energy. Maybe, he posits, it has to do with how I'd simply made myself more comfortable in the cold. Being cold forces you to use more energy. It's like a low-grade passive workout for your whole cardiovascular system, he muses. Research, he notes, indicates that cold exposure increases mitochondrial formation throughout the body, which would mean, overall, more aerobic power. Positive results are all the more impressive because my actual workout routine hasn't changed more drastically than adding cold showers and morning breathing sessions. When I first met Hoff in Poland almost 4 years earlier, I weighed 210 pounds. Now I'm 178. More than that, I'd proven that I could handle altitude and freezing cold. I'd also climbed the tallest mountain in Africa. On one level, I'm incredibly pleased with how the tests came out. But I think the reasons behind the improved test results run deeper than cold exposure and breathing exercises alone. They stem from a deep connection that I am forming with the world around me. It's something that I hope that anyone can at least try for themselves. Every nerve ending that connects our skin to our brains yearns to understand the world around it in order to help make appropriate decisions about how best to go on living. Most of these signals happen below our conscious understanding in the relays of our most lizard-like brain structures. These pathways are the programming that has been passed down by countless generations of ancestors all the way back to the very inception of mammalian life itself. The biological relationship between life and its environment is the most ancient transfer of knowledge that any human can ever experience. It's so ingrained in our very beings that the language of evolutionary programming isn't a thought. It's just a feeling, a shiver, a rush of blood, or a quickening of the senses. Just 100 years ago, most of us knew the language of shivering. 1,000 years before that, our bodies tracked with the seasons. 10,000 years or more before that, our species migrated between continents on rafts of seaweed and surmounted mountains in little more than animal skins and leather soles. Those ancestors probably didn't think of themselves as different from the environment at all. They knew what we are all learning again today, that we're all just here, surviving, together. Even though our nervous systems crave connection to the world they evolved in, The tendency in the modern era is to think of humanity as fundamentally different than everything else. We insist on being bounded by our bodies, our property, our kinship network, and our social media profiles, and so we hold the rest of the planet at arm's length. The combined effect of billions of people sharing that same atomistic mindset has set the world off kilter. As I was writing this book, 2015 and 2016 were among the hottest years ever recorded. In the years to come, actually finding cold will become more difficult as winters become milder and summers all the more scorching. There may come a time when finding an ice-covered lake in Boston will be impossible. On a global scale, climate change is just another signifier that humans are inextricably part of the environment. Humanity has used its cerebral ingenuity to extract the stored energy of the planet for its own purposes. The collective action of our carbon dioxide emissions, rampant pollution from the Industrial Revolution onward, and the mass extinction of animal life are just a few iconic ways that we've steered the environment towards our own, ultimately destructive ends. The process has been mostly unconscious. No one planned the destruction of the planet. But the results are so massive that they almost seem calculated. In a way, you could say that humanity itself is the world's conscious nervous system. And, just as our own bodies have grown weaker as a result of clinging to comfort and using our gadgets to appease our inner drive for homeostasis, the alterations we've made to the planet through technology have undermined its fundamental equilibrium. Of course, modern technology has done good as well as harm for our species. Human life expectancy is far higher now than at any time in history. While our Paleolithic ancestors might have had better teeth, stronger muscles, and hardier immune systems, they also faced lethal challenges that cut most of them down by their mid-30s. Infant and maternal mortality was obscenely high. Epidemics repeatedly wiped out entire cities during the Middle Ages. All told, I'd rather be alive now than at any other time in history. Technology gives us superpowers. And so what if I can't always find my way around a city without my phone's GPS? I've had the amazing opportunity to travel to far-flung parts of the planet in a way that would have been almost unthinkable even a generation ago. Flitting from Colorado to Moshi to Amsterdam and London, all in just a matter of months. I've had my own limits tested in state-of-the-art laboratories and with some of the most inspiring athletes on the planet. I'm lucky. Then again, we all are. I'm not going to make an appeal for anyone to try to get up and save the planet or alter the course of human history. I will, however, note that every one of us has an opportunity right now to connect with the world around us. If you've been wrapped in a thermogenic cocoon for your whole life, then your nervous system is aching for input. All you need to do is get a little bit outside of your comfort zone and try something out of the ordinary. Try finding comfort in the cold. You've nothing to lose. Just breathe. The end.
This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.